45 years ago, Americans hotly debated the war in Vietnam. Whether for it or against it, you knew what was going on and how many people were dying. That's not how we conduct wars today. Scott Horton is a journalist and human rights lawyer and our guest this hour. He says the nation's national security elite spies on citizens, tortures suspected terrorists, and launches deadly drone strikes while shielding its actions from a public that no longer seems to care. Though President Obama has asked Congress to authorize a limited war against the Islamic State, Scott Horton says high-level White House and national security operatives have amassed dangerous and unprecedented powers thanks to their ability to declare their activities national secrets. We'll hear from him next, after the news. And welcome to Midday, our second hour. Dan Roderick's here. Thanks again for joining us. U.S. is escalating a secretive war in Afghanistan. That was the lead headline in Friday's New York Times. Maybe you saw it and said, wait a minute, didn't the president say our war there was over? Or maybe you just shrugged it off. Our next guest says that's more likely the case. Scott Horton, an award-winning contributing editor at Harper's Magazine and longtime human rights lawyer, says our national security bureaucracy has run amok and few seem to care. Consider the massive government spying on ordinary citizens disclosed by Edward Snowden, the kidnapping and torture of suspected terrorists, many of whom had committed no crime, and a deadly 10-year secret drone war in Pakistan that may have made as many enemies as it eliminated. Scott Horton says each of those are symptoms of a national security bureaucracy that has assumed unprecedented power and operates without accountability thanks to the weapon of secrecy and the threat of punishment for whistleblowers. In a new book called Lords of Secrecy, Scott Horton argues that several forces have created what he sees as a real threat to America's democratic principles. One is the all-volunteer army. Our current servicemen and women are there because they want to be, so the draft is gone, and with it, large-scale public concern with the excesses of warfare. Another is the advent of weapons such as drones, which keep U.S. casualties to a minimum. The increased outsourcing of war to private security contractors is another factor. The public doesn't like mercenaries, doesn't really care what happens to them. Mercenaries make it easier to keep secrets, too. Finally, Scott Horton says Congress has virtually abandoned its traditional role of oversight despite massive public outrage about spying on ordinary Americans' phone calls, for instance. Congress has yet to act on legislation to limit spy masters. What does this collective shoulder-shrugging mean for the future of democracy? That's a big question. That's what we'll ask Scott Horton, a New York-based human rights lawyer and contributing editor at Harper's, where his reporting on legal and national security issues won a National Magazine Award. A longtime critic of torturing suspected terrorists, he's a former president of the International League for Human Rights. As a practicing attorney, Scott Horton has focused on investment in emerging markets, as well as human rights, serving as counsel to Andrei Sakharov, Elena Bonner, and other dissidents in the former Soviet Union. He's regularly appeared before Congress, too, testifying on questions of accountability by military contractors and the Justice Department's management of public integrity issues. Scott lectures at Columbia Law School. His new book, again, Lords of Secrecy, The National Security Elite and America's Stealth Warfare. It's available from Nation Books. Scott Horton, welcome to the Midday Show on WYPR. It's a pleasure to get to speak with you.
Dan, it's great to be with you.
One of the key premises in the book is that the way we, the public, feels about wars, the way presidents carry them out, it just has changed so much from that era I spoke of earlier, 40, 50 years ago during the Vietnam War. What changed?
Well, I think it's really a sort of core question of how our democracy works. And from the beginning of the Republic up until just a few decades ago, decisions about when we went to war or when we made peace were right at the heart of our democracy. They were frequently highly contentious. I mean, we had a few wars like World War II where there was broad deep consensus in support of the war effort. But we have many other wars throughout American history, like the Mexican-American War and the war with Spain, which were bitterly contentious, and the Vietnam War, for instance. So we've had this very, very long legacy of deep, profound public engagement in these sorts of issues. And now we see it just beginning to fade away. And you already walked us through some of the major considerations. So, you know, one of them certainly had always been the idea of a citizen army. So citizen soldiers fight our wars. Americans care about what happens to their brothers, sisters, parents, and so forth. They care greatly about them. They care when they come home badly wounded or dead. So that had served to anchor fundamental public interest. So moving to a volunteer army, moving to military contractors, moving to robotic warfare takes us quite a distance away from that. But secrecy is another part of it. Secrecy is a sort of narcotic. So it sort of sucks the oxygen out of the room. There's not enough information for people to have and form opinions about some of these matters. Therefore, we don't have public discussion about them, and the public is not engaged. And I think we've seen that in the course of the last 10 years, again, with secret wars, which is a rising phenomenon. Of course, we've had that to some extent throughout our history, but never the way we have them today.
Well, there it is, right off the front page of the Times on Friday, U.S. escalating a secretive war in Afghanistan. And I think I'm correct about what I said about that. A lot of Americans might look at that and say, okay, wars need to be secret. They can't be telling us what they're doing over there. I'm assuming that they are protecting us from further 9/11s. Others may not just may not care about it.
Yes. I mean, there's a fundamental distinction you have to make between tactical decisions in a war. That is, you know, the government's decided it's going to strike an Islamist terrorist leader who's present in a certain village at a certain time with a certain sort of weapon, and it's striking him based on certain evidence that's been collected from primary sources. That's tactical information which the public really does not have a legitimate right to know. And indeed, keeping that information secret is very important for the effectiveness of the war effort. But now let's go the next step and let's assume that the CIA or JSOC are going to wage a 10-year war that consists of many hundreds, perhaps thousands of such strikes using drone missiles, that it's going to go on for 10 years, that it'll produce 3,000 or 4,000 casualties. And this is a sustained military campaign. That's an example of something which in prior contemplation has been viewed as a war or a long-term military operation that the public had a right to know about, had a right to understand why the government is doing this, for what purpose, a right to understand what the government's objectives were and how the government intended to define success and terminate the effort. And it's this second type of conflict that's disappearing from the public table. And a clear-cut example of that is the drone war that's been going on in Pakistan over now more than 10 years, which has claimed certainly more than 4,000 casualties, and really is a full-fledged war. It's a third or fourth theater in our Middle East counterterrorism campaign. But because the government decided that this was a covert operation or a series of covert operations, we've had no public debate about it, no accountability, no really firm or clear decisions by the government as a whole to do this, and no mobilization of public opinion to support the effort. So it's an example of the dangerous new kind of secret war.
Well, President Obama came into office, promising a more open and transparent government, promising to wrap up these two wars. And when it comes to drone warfare in particular and surveillance, he's gone the other way.
I think that's clearly correct. And I think it's, you know, comes as I say, a surprise to many people who studied the national security policies that Obama put forward during the 2008 campaign, where he set down some markers. And I think he did that both with an affirmative vision and specific targeted criticisms of things that the Bush administration had done. And he, in fact, specifically criticized the excessive secrecy of the Bush operations and the heavy reliance on military contractors. In fact, I had a meeting with him at one point when the Senate was looking at some of that legislation. So he staked out very clear-cut positions. But now we see President Obama doing very little that indicates a shift from the prior government. Rather, it's more or less government on autopilot on most of these issues. And I think, you know, one way of looking at this is to say that these matters really are dominated by a professional national security bureaucracy, a set of elites who operate very secretively, and they have been making the decisions for a long time, and they're very resistant to political positions that try to change the situation. They resist those things ferociously sometimes and keep their course head on with little change. And so I think you see Obama perhaps intending to make some changes, but in fact effectuating virtually no changes.
Well, in light of what you described there, Scott, I need to ask you about the president's latest effort here when it comes to openness or going to Congress for authorization for what's already been, a 6 or 7 month old military campaign against the Islamic State, against ISIS. But he's saying, it's very interesting because he's saying, I want 3 years and I don't want ground troops, although we may use special ops commandos. This was not going to be some large-scale ground combat operation. So he's saying to Congress, I want authorization to go ahead with this, but I want you to limit my powers. So what do you make of that?
Well, that's right. I mean, I'd say to start off here, over the last several months, I and many other people have been very critical of the administration over their failure to properly consult Congress and seek specific authority for their actions and their failure to present a public justification for their policies. And then, interestingly enough, when you discuss many of these points with senior people in the White House, they don't push back aggressively. They say, yes, you're right, that does need to happen. And sometime in the first quarter of this year, the president will make this proposal. So it has happened. So I think but the first criticism that has to be raised here is one of timing. So, it shouldn't be a Band-Aid being applied many, many months after the fact. Oh, we forgot to do that. Now let's go back and do it. Where you're presenting Congress with a fait accompli. This is our policy. This is what we're doing. This is what we've been doing for many months. Now you approve it after the fact. Then putting Congress in the position where if they say no, well, you've got commitments you made out in the field that you may not be supporting anymore. It makes it very, very difficult for Congress to do anything other than say yes. We have a tremendous time delay. But then you also look at what it is that's being proposed. And, of course, it's not terribly clear what it is that's being – it is some sort of military effort targeting ISIS, a specific terrorist group. It does not include approval for boots on the ground. It does include other sorts of support. So latent in the proposal that the White House is putting forward is this sort of idea that, well, you know, the public – and Congress really have a right to say something and to approve things when we deploy large numbers of boots on the ground for a sustained period of time. We acknowledge that, but we're not doing that. So, you know, we're moving into an area where they really don't have that much to say about it. It's within the discretion of the president. And, you know, that's a huge policy issue, I think.
But he could go ahead and do what he wants. Pretty much. He's been doing that for 6 months.
He has been doing it not just for 6 months. He's been doing it throughout his presidency.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I think you go back and you look at what he did in 2011 in Libya. It's another example of the same thing. In fact, in the case of Libya in 2011, he and senior members of his administration were telling the public very aggressively,
we're not going to war in Libya. We've made our decision. We're not going to do it. And they turned on a dime within 48 hours. And the next thing we knew, F-16s were flying shorties, and we were launching cruise missiles and deploying drones. So, you know, it was rather a surprise. And also, again, look at 2012, 2013 in Syria, where, you know, we had the Red Line incident. We had a number of threats of intervention, and then he pulled back from them. But in no case was the president saying, well, you know, I've got to go get Congress's authorization or support, or even I have to build specific public support for whatever program I'm going to embark on. No, the White House's view has been largely, well, this is really for me and my national security advisors to decide what we're going to do.
Scott Horton is our guest in this hour of midday, a New York-based human rights lawyer and contributing editor at Harper's. He's written a new book called Lords of Secrecy, The National Security Elite and America's Stealth Warfare. Folks, here's the question for you to consider during this hour as we talk with Scott Horton. Do you care about this? Are you content with the way things are, the surveillance state, the drone warfare? Do you think the president really needs to get Congress's approval to carry out operations against ISIS, the Islamic State terrorist group? How do you feel about this? 410-662-8780 is the local number. Toll-free long distance for the midday show, 866-661-9309. Is Scott Horton correct that we really don't care? We just shrug and go about our business? Midday's email address, you can send us a question or comment that way too. midday@wypr.org. Secrecy has transformed both the way America wages war around the world and the way it shares information about threats and its own operations with the American people. Today, Americans know less about what their national security forces are doing than ever before, and Americans frequently know less than citizens of other nations. I quote there from Scott Horton's book, Lords of Secrecy, The National Security Elite and America's Stealth Warfare. If you weren't concerned about government spying, secrecy, and lack of responsiveness to public opinion before, you will be after you read this book. Scott, who are the Lords of Secrecy in the title of your book?
Well, the Lords of Secrecy are the senior echelon of leaders of the nation's national security and intelligence agencies. There are 26 of them altogether, and they are given the power under federal law to create secrets. And they use that power zealously. In fact, one of the surprising things is if we just log the number of secrets created, we see a steady flow of them, of course, during the Cold War. And when it was over and we expected to see some major dividend, you know, around 1996, 97, 98, in fact, Congress passed new legislation. The president issued a new executive order, making it much more difficult to create new secrets. And what happened? There was another secrecy explosion, actually. We had many more secrets. And then it exploded again after 9/11. So we now have many more secrets being created than ever before. And historically, this has been led by the Department of Defense and the CIA. But if we look at the last 10 years, we see some change in the structure of who makes secrets. So the field is now really being dominated by the CIA and the NSA, a new player, which now has an incredibly important role in the process of making and keeping secrets.
General James Clapper, I wanted to bring him up here, the Director of National Intelligence, who famously said that the NSA, which is located not far from where I'm speaking to you, does not collect any type of data at all on millions of Americans. And, you know, we've learned so much about the domestic surveillance of the NSA from Edward Snowden and others in the last couple of years. But I wonder, again, as a measure here, it must be frustrating for you to look at this, the moral questions about it, and see the American public just, you know, I don't know. They call into our show and complain about it, but there seems to be a general shrug about this out there.
Well, we need to start off by saying, of course, that statement by General Clapper was not true.
Right. Yeah.
Very important to note that.
Yes.
And he was called on the carpet by it, accused by both Republicans and Democrats of having lied to Congress, which indeed he did. Even his own lawyer said, well, he was telling a relatively innocuous lie.
Mm.
But this is an area where, excuse me, historically, leaders of the intelligence community had, when they were hit with questions like this, rather than say something overtly untrue, as he did, they'd say, well, I'll answer that in executive session. But today there seems to be a much more robust willingness to lie, to divert public knowledge of these things. And I think in large measure, there's absolutely no doubt. In fact, statements have been made by General Clapper, by some of his predecessors, by General Alexander, in which they acknowledge that, you know, one of the major reasons for the deception of the public is concern about how the public would react if they knew in detail everything that was being done. And that is that the NSA, in fact, does engage in very deep data trolling. That is, every communication you have using the internet, every communication you have using your cell phone is something as to which at least some level of data is now being captured by the NSA, and it's being held indefinitely. So, you know, there may be no reason for them to collect data on you right now, but part of the justification that they advance internally is, well, who knows if this person won't become a criminal at some point in the future, and then we'll find out that there is a need to know what this person was doing 8 or 9 years ago. So it is a panopticon state that they're trying to create, one in which the state has sight into all of your dealings that you may have thought previously were confidential and secretive. And I think, what's the reaction from the American public? Well, I think what we see that people who understand what's happened and who have they've read about it, they understand what the PRISM program is, they understand the details of it, and they understand that they were being misled not only by officials from the intelligence service but also by government other government officials, including congressmen and congresswomen, about this, are very angry about it. So that's particularly when we look at certain demographic groups, young people who are really quite tech savvy. They're angry and they're unhappy about what the government's doing. But we have other large parts of the population who don't understand so well what's going on, who broadly accept that the government is doing what it's doing in their interest and that these are legitimate counterterrorism measures. So we have, you know, we have a broad spectrum of reactions, but some very important groups being very, very unhappy about it. And also, I'd say, our allies overseas, and importantly, there in many areas, Germany, where I spend a lot of time these days, and I've given a lot of talks there, I find actually German audiences are much more sophisticated about these things than American audiences are. They understand in depth exactly what's going on, and they're pretty bitter and resentful about it. But it doesn't change their attitude towards the United States. They're overwhelmingly and very strongly pro-U.S., but they've developed a very negative attitude towards the NSA and the CIA. That I can say. That's absolutely the case.
I just want to examine a little bit the public attitude, Scott. I just want to stick with this just for a little bit longer here, because I don't mean to trivialize anything by saying that the public shrugs, but I wonder what's going on here. We mentioned the draft. There's the 9/11, you know, that remains in the American memory. But I want to talk about the draft, because this is something I've thought about a lot. The lack of a draft, the lack of skin in the game, so to speak, by the parts of most Americans, and the attitude that, you know, people in the all-volunteer military signed up for this duty. We may sympathize with them, you know, the wounded warriors and all, but, you know, they're the ones that took the risks. We assume that they knew the risks when they signed up. You know, just address this a little bit. How do you get Americans riled up not only about the president's war powers and the use of drones around the world and what the secrecy, but also the surveillance? How do you get the population aroused about this?
Well, one of my core points here is that we had this major transformation about the way our country goes about fighting war. That has really deep consequences for our democracy. And this transformation occurred without much or really any public discussion or deliberation of it. It just sort of happened, and it happened according to a very deeply prepared plan that the national security elites pushed forward. But I think we need to start with the idea of the military. So if you go back to the founding of America, the idea of the citizen soldier, that is, we were not going to have a large standing military apparatus, but our citizens would call when needed. They would rise to the defense of their country, and they would be motivated by valor, patriotism, and a love of their own country rather than by money and the way they behaved. This was an absolutely foundational value of the country that had been sustained throughout our history. And then we see in the wake of Vietnam, it just being dismantled and shoved aside. And even going the next step when we move to a volunteer army, we see a sort of systematic denigration of the role even of our volunteer military with leaders in our Defense Department and leaders in the national security apparatus saying, well, you know, uniformed American service personnel, they're just not as efficient as contractors. Contractors are better. By the way, there was never any real evidence put forward for that. And in fact, I think the evidence all cuts exactly in the opposite direction. Uniformed soldiers are actually more efficient and more motivated than contractors are, and they're less expensive than contractors. But nevertheless, you know, a strong decision was taken to migrate almost the entire defense budget from our uniformed soldiery to our contractors. And then there was this decision to invest very heavily in robotics, and robotics is a new kind of warfare, with the idea all along that this gives the national security elites the ultimate say about waging war. You know, that any real legitimate public interest in whether we're going and waging war in certain parts of the world, when we're doing it with robotics, it just doesn't matter. And in fact, there's a Department of Justice opinion that was issued on April 1st, 2011, supporting the effort in Libya, which actually says this, you know, because there's no real risk of American soldiers being harmed or being killed in this war because of our new technological breakthroughs, there's just not so much interest for Congress or the people to become involved in these decisions. They really are decisions for the executive branch and for the national security elites. These all of these steps and this attitude is simply horrific. And to me, it's amazing that there has not been blowback over it, that there's not been a real meaningful public debate about these things. And it moves us in a direction in which we really cease to be a democracy. And I say that because we have a lot of people today who think democracy is we pick between some well-groomed and attractive candidates. But if you look back at the historical understanding of democracy, that actually has almost nothing to do with democracy. Democracy is the people of a country making vital decisions about the country for themselves. And that has always meant, first and foremost, when they go to war and when they make peace.
Scott Horton, our guest on Midday. His book is Lords of Secrecy, The National Security Elite and America's Stealth Warfare, published by Nation Books. Here's a call for Scott. This is Ted. Scott, Ted's calling from the Eastern Shore of Maryland in Centerville. Ted, go right ahead.
Thanks, Ted. I think there's a very interesting underlying set of facts that haven't been brought into the conversation up until now, and that is that the reason DOD has had to outsource some of this intelligence gathering, and that we're using means like drones and anything else that we can really get our hands on, is the task of getting intelligence to defend this country has gotten way more complicated, several orders of magnitude, because of the impact of these technologies. I was nearly drafted, and I got involved in strategic intelligence. And I can tell you that strategic intelligence that we did 25, 30 years ago was nothing like this. So So we've commented a lot on how the face of warfare has changed and how terrorists have much more capabilities. But I think part of the problem is to counter that, you have to acquire that technology, and there's a certain degree of secrecy because if the enemy finds out about it, then you do not succeed. And then finally, we don't have a choice but to succeed in this fight. And I think the general American view is that, hey, there may be a few corners cut here and there, but if it's all part of defending our country, then they're for it.
Ted, thank you. Scott?
Well, I think this is a vital point, in fact. One of the fundamental questions here is being masters of technology and not allowing technology to be a master of you. And the United States' rise as the paramount military power in the world, you know, which occurred in the course of the last century, was really anchored in the course of World War II. The U.S. rise had to do with U.S. mastery of technology, and that started with the air, and it moved on to outer space and all sorts of other technologies. And, you know, drones, if you look in the whole history of this, is like not a really particularly impressive new technology. It's certainly nothing compared to the bomb at the end of World War II. But nevertheless, it has vast and important consequences. And in my view, one of the really key points here is that that our movement into this area, our movement into the use of drones and drone warfare, has occurred in the background secretly, without allowing the public and Congress to be masters of the fundamental policy debate. And one thing that happened here was. Drone technology, and by the way, I think no reasonable person is going to say you shouldn't use drones. Of course, we should make use of all these technological innovations. That's the essence of our strength, and it's essential to our national defense. But we now are in a situation in which the CIA, having gotten got control of drones for their information gathering capabilities, now is using them as a means of warfare, covert warfare. And that means the CIA effectively is operating its own Air Force. And this is not what the law actually authorizes or what was ever contemplated. You know, so the one major question I raise and discuss here is why is the CIA operating armed drones, predator drones, and other lethal weaponries that historically have always been managed by the Air Force and by other uniformed services? And they got this. It just happened. And when you confront legal officers at the CIA, they get very uncomfortable about this because they're really not in a position to clearly justify how they're operating these things. There should be a public discussion about it. I think any discussion would result in these weapon systems going back to the Pentagon where they belong. And also being used in conjunction with clear doctrines for their use. And that's what we've always done historically up to this point. It's stopped recently. Now, there are legitimate interests in keeping secrecy surrounding the technology, but that doesn't stop a fair and well-informed public discussion of the policy aspects of their use.
Highly corrosive to any democracy, you say. All this secrecy and the lowering of public interest, the American public's interest in this large question about going to war, corrosive to democracy.
Yes. In essence, democracy, our concept of democracy in the United States has always been knowledge-based democracy. That is, people are bring to bear their knowledge and their experience on affairs that affect the country as a whole. There is public discourse and debate about them, and through that process, we're able to reach resolutions that serve the interests of the people as a whole. That's the essence of what American democracy has always been. So when you take large areas of knowledge off the table by declaring them secret, you make it very difficult to have a properly informed public discussion. And ultimately, you're saying, well, this just isn't for the people at all. It's just for the national security experts to decide. And, you know, once you do that, and once the people are not involved in decision-making about issues of war and peace, in my view, you're just not a democracy anymore. So you couldn't get more corrosive than that.
Scott Horton, our guest in this hour of Midday on WYPR, a contributing editor at Harper's Magazine who covers legal national security issues. His book is Lords of Secrecy, The National Security Elite and America's Stealth Warfare. If you have a question or comment, please feel free to join us in this hour of the show with Scott Horton. You can reach us right now at 410-662-8780, toll-free long distance, 866-661-9309. Our email address, midday@wypr.org, and we're on Twitter at @MiddayWYPR. And welcome back to the Midday Show. Dan Rodericks here. Scott Horton, my guest, with his book, Lords of Secrecy, The National Security Elite and America's Stealth Warfare. Has the Obama administration done a better job at protecting whistleblowers concerned about violations of privacy, concerned about our surveillance state?
No. And in fact, Barack Obama, again, during the 2008 campaign, he issued a public statement saying that he appreciated the important role of whistleblowers. He had, early in his career as a lawyer, defended a whistleblower. And he was committed to strengthening the Freedom of Information Act and taking other steps to protect whistleblowers. But in this critical area of national security whistleblowers, we see an explosion of really aggressive and very heavy-handed prosecution under President Obama. So if we look at Espionage Act prosecutions, which is the most heavy-handed sort of prosecution that can occur, there are 9 prosecutions now, and that is that's more than double. That's approaching 3 times the total number of prosecutions from every president from Woodrow Wilson through George W. Bush. So he has been far more aggressive in the way he's handled them. And then if you look at the management of some of these individual prosecutions, the heavy-handedness, the really sort of coarse conduct against defendants has been really appalling. You know, one case, the Thomas Drake case, mm-hmm. which occurred in federal court in Maryland, right. I discuss in some depth in my book. And that's a case where the judge at Drake's sentencing at the end used the sentencing hearing to lash out against the Justice Department and accuse them of conduct which was more egregious than that of the British before the American Civil War, and their intimidation and harshness. You know, raiding people's homes, sticking guns in people's faces. And it turned out all the suspicions against Drake were wrong from the beginning. So I think this is very troubling. And also I think, the whistleblower issue is a huge one in addressing the secrecy problem, because right now we have, way too many secrets. I think everybody agrees that there are way too many secrets. And how do you address that? How do you get enough information into the public arena, so that people can be informed? And there are many different courses. You know, we could have deregulation of secrecy. We could have General Clapper just releasing vast amounts of information. In fact, he's tried that a little bit. We could have Congress doing information dumps. We could have the press disclosing information. The press can really only work effectively when there are whistleblowers out there providing them information.
Right. Right.
So this relationship between whistleblowers and the press is really key to addressing the issue.
Scott, I'd like you to address this comment from David, who's writing to us from West Virginia. He says, since the enemies, such as ISIS, are operating in secret for their attacks on civilizations 2 millennia ahead of their mindset, I have no problem fighting them in secret. Information collected to win that fight is all right by me, provided the information is not made public. And he's referring there in parentheses to, you know, personal information about Americans. I would like more coordination with other allies under attack, France, Denmark, Great Britain, for instance. So how do you respond to David, who says, I'm all right with this because this is a different kind of enemy that operates in secret, and you have to have secrets in order to find them, isolate them, and deal with them.
No, I don't think that there's any issue about that. I mean, I think it is axiomatic that we will use secrecy and we will use aggressive surveillance techniques targeting terrorist groups of this sort, and that is completely legitimate. So that there's really not an issue about that. The question that arises is developing these new surveillance techniques and then using them on everyone. That is people who are like Ted and the Eastern Shore and any of our other callers also going through their emails and listening in on their phone conversations. I mean, what we're doing right now is data trawling that amasses enormous quantities of data. And what we really need to be doing is focusing in laser-like on specific individuals who are likely sources of good information about terrorist activities. So, you know, certainly it's never been my view that we don't need an NSA and we don't need a CIA. Of course, we need intelligence analysis and we need signals intelligence capacity. And those are vital tools to use in conflicts of this sort. It's just a question of going too far and too deep with this and collecting information about people who are not in any way directly or indirectly related to legitimate targets.
You know, we had a congressman from Maryland, he's still a congressman, Dutch Ruppersberger, who said in order to find the needle in the haystack, you need the whole haystack. And then he walked back several months later. He walked back from that statement about the NSA operations.
Well, I think, you know, one of the really amazing things right now is we have this vast data trawling, but our analytical capabilities are very, very weak. And I think we see that in things like the Arab Spring, but also like this eruption with ISIS. There is vast amount of data that's been collected, these many, many haystacks, not just one. But we have very few language specialists, area specialists. We have relatively weak collection of human intelligence on the ground. And the result is that over and over again, we don't see these things coming. You know, we did not understand Arab Spring when it was about to happen. And when ISIS struck and achieved its successes, its breakthrough successes in northern Iraq and northern Syria, that came as quite a surprise to the intelligence community too. So I would say there are huge problems out there, and they have to do with the quality of the intelligence operations.
Here's another question, a call from another listener, Jeffrey in Baltimore. You're on with Scott Horton. Hi.
Hello. How are you doing?
Okay.
You know, my thought is, and I'm very concerned about this state, this intelligence, national intelligence state, but I think part of the problem is why Americans seem to be just shrugging their shoulders, is that oftentimes those people who are trying to alert us to these issues and the media who should be covering it, but we know their problem, don't really relate to some of the more egregious violations of law. You know, one example is not necessarily having to do specifically with this and trolling our intelligence, but, you know, the administration in 2012 with that Defense Appropriation Act had a rider that empowered our national intelligence agencies to detain Americans and theoretically even on U.S. soil without habeas corpus indefinitely. And I remember when the president issued a signing statement promising that he would only use that wisely. And these kind of violations of law, clearly, I don't think get enough coverage from both the people who are trying to alert us to this issue and, of course, the media. You know, they're pretty much fairly hopeless. But I think the more that we were hearing about these more egregious things, I think the more people will become concerned, because that's a very dangerous thing.
Thank you, Jeffrey. Do you think the mainstream media is hopeless on this count, Scott?
Well, I hope not. You know, I mean, I think we have some really very, very good national security reporting out there. But we also have a lot of really very mediocre national security reporting. And I think, you know, one thing that came out that was just fascinating in Dianne Feinstein's committee's report
on the Black Site and Torture Program is it included, quite a surprise to me, a major study of the way the CIA dealt with the media. One thing that emerges from that is that the CIA understands the problems and difficulties that national security writers face, and it exploits those for propaganda purposes. And as a result, the national security elites really do very effectively manage American media, which is not to say that there aren't good reporters out there doing their best to break through with good news, but I think it also helps you understand the point that Jeff is making about sometimes alarm bells aren't sounded when they should be.
What do we do about this? It goes back to my question about public attitude, what's at stake for the democracy. I note here in a story I read about the president's request for authority from Congress for his military campaign against the Islamic State, that there's already been 1,900 airstrikes against ISIS, airstrikes and I guess some missile strikes. 1,900, that's a lot. That's a big number. Maybe it pales by comparison to other operations. But, you know, do Americans even know about that? Did you, until I just mentioned this number to you, dear listeners, did you have any idea that we were working on that kind of a scale over there? And does it matter to you? That's the question. So I want to hear from Scott on this, that your takeaway on this President's Day about the president's powers and where we are with all this, what we really should be concerned about.
Well, in fact, note that we had a number of senior Republican politicians sharply criticizing President Obama, saying that they wish that their president were being as aggressive in dealing with ISIS as the King of Jordan was.
Hmm.
And of course, this just shows they're not informed because, of course, the U.S. has been leading the effort and has had 10 or 15 or 20 strikes for every one that's been launched by the Jordanians.
Right.
But the administration has had a posture of actually wanting to downplay all this, not wanting to dramatize the American role, not wanting to attract public attention to what the United States is doing. And I think that's a huge problem because the public in the U.S. should know what the U.S. is doing. They should understand what President Obama's strategy is exactly and what he intends to achieve. And, you know, the president really should be trying to build public support for whatever he wants to do, not sweep it under the carpet. And this, I think, is a big problem with the current administration, but it was also a problem with its predecessor.
Scott Horton, it's been a pleasure to have you on the show today. And I'm glad you put all this together in this book, Lords of Secrecy, a recommended reading for people concerned about the future here of U.S. warfare and the powers of the presidency and that elite that Scott's talking about, this national security elite that's developed. It's called Lords of Secrecy, the National Security Elite in America's Stealth Warfare. Scott Horton is a contributing editor at Harper's Magazine, a recipient of the National Magazine Award for reporting for his writing on law and national security issues. And he joined us from New York today. Thank you very much, Scott.
Great to be with you.
Yep, nice to have you on the show. Further reading on that, you can find references to Scott's book on the Dan Roderick's Facebook page. Also, this story about President Obama and the powers that he's seeking to conduct war in against the ISIS state, all on the Dan Roderick's Facebook page. Please keep in touch. Our midday email address, midday@wypr.org for our staff here at Midday. I hope you have a great afternoon and stay warm. We'll see you back here again tomorrow.
Midday senior producer is Nikki Gamer. The producer is Maureen Harvey. The associate producer is Michael Hemowitz. Our interns are Carrie DeSantis, David Richman, and Marjorie Goodman. Midday's engineer is Luke Spicknell. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcast and live streaming is available at wypr.org. Dan Roderick's column appears in the Baltimore Sun. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.